You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for coming to this wonderful event. I would like to introduce our two speakers. The first is Professor Andre Spicer. Andre is professor of organizational behavior and the founding director of ETHOS, the Center for Responsible Enterprise at Cass Business School here in London. The other speaker is Carl Siderstorm. He's an associate professor at the business school in Sweden, in Stockholm. Now, both are accomplished writers, have published numerous scientific articles, books, and this new book, which we are presenting today, is called The Wellness Syndrome. After our discussion, the audience will have the chance to buy the book and get the signature from the authors. I'm very pleased to chair this discussion today, since a few years ago, I was privileged to present here my work on the tyranny of choice. And I feel that the wellness syndrome that Carl and Andre are discussing is sort of a sequel to my work, which was sort of focusing on why we are feeling so much more anxious today, and you know, why we feel that everything about our body life is a matter of choice. Andrew and Carl show us that today's post-industrial capitalism very much relies precisely on this anxiety and especially on the obsession with our health and body. In the book, they give numerous examples how enterprises today are almost forcing people to engage in various wellness programs. And instead of getting a raise at your job, you're usually getting a free ticket for the fitness. Now, this free ticket is less and less a matter of choice. You're almost obliged to follow a particular kind of wellness program to become, in a way, more competitor in the workplace. They also point out that we are living in time of some kind of a new bio-morality, where we are supposed to be disgusted by what other people are eating, especially if they're eating unhealthy food, how they look, and we are especially supposed to be in charge of how our body and health is going to turn out. More and more, we feel incredibly responsible about everything related to how we look, how long we live, how well we are, how fit we are. They also point out that we live in times of kind of a new moral businesses, where we are bombarded with the apps and advice on how to become better, or especially how to become, in a way, well. Now, this obsession with body transformation and body modification, unfortunately, had replaced questions about social and economic problems. And that's sort of the main point of the book, that in the times of wellness, we are forgetting about social inequalities, we are forgetting about miserable pace that people are getting, and we are focusing on making people feel guilty for things about health, the body shape, and so on, where actually we have far less power than we are supposed to have. So I will now ask both of our speakers to present the main ideas of their work, and then I will open the floor to discussion.
Thank you very much, Renata. And perhaps this would also be a good time to say that when Andre and I discussed how we wanted this book to appear, not just in its content, but also in form, we always looked at Renata Salekel's wonderful book, Choice or Tyranny of Choice. So we'll just give you something of the overarching argument of this book before the discussion. So as students at the École Normale Supérieure, Sartre and his close friends had more important things to contemplate than their personal wellness. A generous observer might have described their diet as varied, a massive intake of stodgy books alternated with laxatives consisting of cigarettes, coffee, and hard liquor. In a world defined by absurdity, there were more acute issues to deal with than your own personal wellness. For Sartre said, being student was to engage promiscuously with thinking and to take risks with your mind, not to waste time on how to eat correctly.
Slightly less than a century later, we find a new trend in North American universities. To shape their lives in the image of well-being, thousands of students across the United States sign up to wellness contracts. You agree to a lifestyle aimed at enhancing body, mind, and soul. If you sign the Campus Wellness Agreement at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, you promise to maintain an alcohol and drug-free existence. You'll get a taste of such contracts called a holistic approach to living. There are dozens of wellness contracts across the United States and many, many large universities. While most promote a substance-free lifestyle, each university has its own shtick. North Dakota takes a broad approach, offering social, physical, emotional, environmental, spiritual, and intellectual wellness. At Syracuse, you get group trips to local parks and lakes. You also get nutrition demonstrations, presentations, and meditation, yoga, other forms of stress relief, and you even get parfait nights.
So this may be a good thing for eager young students, at least if you ask their concerned parents. Wellness contracts make sure that students avoid harmful hedonism while encouraging other social activities, such as the parfait night. So what is wrong with turning universities into year-round health spas to help students grow their bodies and minds? The problem, of course, is that this project produces a very particular version of the student, the sanitized and straight-thinking student, who, let us be honest, would not mix very well with Sartre and his friends. What is likely to disappear here is a particular kind of college education where students experiment with transformative politics, take mind-expanding substances, perhaps, encounter the ravages of an unhealthy diet, and experience intense and soul-destroying relationships.
It's not just in some North American college students have been promised to pursue wellness. Today, wellness has become a moral demand about which we are constantly and tirelessly reminded. To be a good person is to constantly find new sources of pleasure. It means turning your whole life into an exercise of wellness optimization. At work, we're kindly offered places on a wellness well-being program. As consumers, we're required to curate a lifestyle aimed at maximising our wellness. When we engage in boring activities, such as washing up the dishes at home, we should think about them improving our mindfulness. And even baking a loaf of bread is now recast as a way of nurturing our well-being. In other words, wellness has wormed its way into every aspect of our lives. A few decades back, wellness was the preserve of a small group of alternative lifestylers. Today, wellness has gone mainstream. It dictates the way we work, how we live, how we study, even how we have sex. Even in the most unexpected places, such as the Ashland Correctional and Federal Correctional Institute in Kentucky, where prisoners undergo wellness programs, we find it. They learn about nutrition, exercise, how to deal with stress.
So our concern is not with wellness per se. Our concern is how wellness has become an ideology. As such, it offers a package of ideas and beliefs which people might find seductive and desirable, although for the most part, they find this to be natural or even inevitable. So the ideological element of wellness is nowhere more visible than when we begin considering how we treat and look upon those people who aren't properly looking after their bodies. These people are demonized as lazy, feeble, or weak-willed. They are seen as obscene deviants, unlawfully and unabashedly enjoying what every sensible person should resist. Smokers are regarded not just as a threat to their own personal well-being, but a threat to society. Some workplaces have moved from banning smoking to banning smokers, shifting the focus from an unhealthy activity to an unhealthy individual. This ideological shift is part of a larger transformation in contemporary culture, where individual responsibility and self-expression are morphed with the mindset of a free market economist. So to stop smoking is not so much about cutting down on your expenses, not even about extending your life expectancy, as it is a necessary strategy to improve your own personal market value. So people who don't carefully cultivate their personal wellness are seen as a direct threat to contemporary society, a society in which illness, as David Harvey reminds us, is defined as the inability to work. Healthy bodies are productive bodies, they are good for business, and the same goes with happiness. Assuming that happy workers are more productive, corporations devise new ways to boost their employees' happiness. From coaching sessions and team-building exercises to the recruitment of chief happiness officers.
The focus of the book is how wellness becomes a moral imperative. Although this argument has been made by a number of other people before, we don't think anyone puts it as well as Alenka Zupančič does in The Odd One In. In this book, she calls it biomorality. This is what she writes. Negativity, lack, dissatisfaction, unhappiness are perceived more and more as moral faults. Worse, as a corruption at the level of very bare being or bare life. There is a spectacular rise of what we might call biomorality, as well as the morality of feelings and emotions, which promotes the following fundamental axiom. A person who feels good and is happy is a good person. A person who feels bad is a bad person. What we encounter here is not so much the punitive paternal superego, which tells you, no, don't do that. Rather, the superego tells us, have fun. To express ourselves, to seize every opportunity in life for enjoyment. But this command is not designed to improve our wellness or to unleash enjoyment. It involves turning enjoyment into an obligation. This is not entirely good news, we think. When enjoyment becomes a demand, the possibility of enjoyment disappears. And the more we try to enjoy, the more guilty we become. Wellness has undergone a similar transformation. Today, wellness is not just something which we choose. It's become a moral obligation. We must consider it at every turn of our lives. While we often see it spelled out in advertisements and lifestyle magazines, this command is transmitted has become more insidious, so that we don't just know whether it is imparted from outside or spontaneously rises within ourselves. This is what we call the wellness command. In addition to identifying the emergence of this wellness command, we want to show how this injunction now begins to work against us. And this is what we call the wellness syndrome.
So the Oxford English Dictionary gives us two different definitions of syndrome. The first refers to a group of symptoms which consistently occur together. So if we keep this definition in mind, we might say that the wellness syndrome refers to symptoms such as anxiety, self-blame, guilt, to name just a few. So the wellness syndrome, and this is a key assumption, is that it's built on the idea of an individual as someone who is autonomous, potent, strong-willed, and relentlessly striving to improve him or herself. So this insistence that the individual is able to choose her own fate provokes a sense of guilt and anxiety. We are thought to be in control of our own lives, even in situations where circumstances are really not in our favor. So job seekers experience this in difficult economic times when they are told not to mention the crisis, but instead put all of the focus onto themselves, asking them the questions what they can do. So finding a job, they are routinely being told, not least by job coaches, is in the end of the day about willpower and their own individual choice. So usually we think about choice as a positive thing, but it brings an overwhelming sense of responsibility into play This is the word of Renata Salakels in her book, Choice. And this is bound up with a fear of failure, a feeling of guilt and an anxiety that regret will follow if we have made the wrong choices. So when wellness goes from being a general idea about feeling good to something that we ought to do in order to live truthfully and righteously, then it takes on a new meaning. It becomes a kind of an impossible demand based on the fantasy of the perfect life, and this reconfigures the way we live. Obsessively tracking our wellness while continuously finding new avenues for self-enhancement, that pretty much leaves very little room to live.
When the body has become the ultimate object of life, a new Archimedean point, the surrounding world is seen as either a threat or a balm. Our body determines where we live, where we spend time, how we exercise, even where we go on holiday. Part of this corporeal obsession is a deep fascination with what we put in our mouths. Indeed, eating has become a kind of a new paranoid activity, which is not intended just to bring momentary pleasures of taste. It becomes a way of putting your identity to the test. Eating correctly is thought to be a way to cook up a happy and prosperous life, free from stress and despair. To eat correctly is an achievement which demonstrates your superior life skills. As the cultural significance of this activity has grown, the market for expert advice has boomed. In the style that blurs New Age sophistry with scientific discoveries, dietitians and chefs, celebrity chefs in particular, have been elevated almost to a priestly status. When we find we cannot find meaning in the rest of our lives, a rare culinary experience becomes a stand-in. One New York Times restaurant critic recently wrote a book describing how 8 women chefs had prepared meals which had literally saved her life. As Pascal Bruckner puts it, the dining table is no longer an altar of succulent delights, a place for sharing a meal and conversation. Instead, it has become a pharmacy counter where we keep an eye on our fats and calories and conscientiously eat food reduced to a form of medication. All the pleasures that we used to indulge from it are now in the pleasures of ultimately one objective, which is to improve our wellness. Wine and fat are perfectly fine as long as you can fit them into your wellness plan.
Opening the dictionary again, we see that a syndrome can also mean a characteristic combination of opinions, emotions, or behavior. The wellness syndrome characteristically combines an obsession with the body with a burning desire for authenticity. So this might seem counterintuitive, because often we think that being preoccupied with our bodies is a way of showing our sort of superficiality. But improving one's body is too often seen to be a way of improving oneself. Improving your body, you're improving yourself. Carl Elliott writes in his book, Better Than Well, that technologies from Prozac to facelifts are routinely described as tools of self-discovery and self-fulfillment. So rather than being narcissistic, the search for personal health and authenticity is regarded as a moral responsibility. As he writes, many people today feel called to pursue self-fulfillment. To devote themselves single-mindedly to a career, for example, or to cultivate a look through severe diets and punishing workouts at the gym, even if it means ignoring their children. When we are trapped by the wellness syndrome, we become what Simon Critchley calls passive nihilists. Rather than acting in the world and trying to transform it, Critchley writes, the passive nihilist simply focuses on himself and his particular pleasures and projects for perfecting himself, whether through discovering the inner child, manipulating pyramids, writing pessimistic-sounding literary essays, taking up yoga, birdwatching, or botany, end of quote. So where does our preoccupation with our own wellness leave the rest of the population who have an acute shortage of organic smoothies, diet apps, and yoga instructors? Thank you.
Thank you, Andre and Carl. To start our discussion, I was sort of reading your book. I was thinking What's the difference between sort of post-industrial capitalism and that you are describing and sort of previous regimes, which also in some way focused on wellness, fitness? I was born and raised in socialist Yugoslavia, and major enterprises focused on sports. They were building sports facilities. They encouraged various games, after work sports events. In China, you know, we had sort of exercise as part of, you know, work ethic. What's the difference between those kinds of focus on wellness and what you're talking about?
Well, it's a very... The Hitler Jugend manual from 1935, on the front cover of that, it says, your body does not belong to you. Your body belongs to the nation. It is your duty to be happy. And I think what might have been the case where you grew up, and in some ways also where I grew up in Sweden as a sort of strong welfare country, is that there is an idea of your body partly belonging to the state, partly belonging to the nation, and where there is a sort of collective pursuit to bring your health up to a certain point to avoid illness and to make sure that people are exercising. I think today that slogan would be very different. I mean, what does our body belong to? It certainly does not belong to the state, I think. If anything, it might belong to the corporation, which we might see in a lot of different examples where people now are being obliged to take part in exercise. This is a particularly popular thing now in Sweden. Just 2 days ago, it was a newspaper article about the new CEO of Björn Borg, you know, the tennis player, but also more associated these days with men's underwear. So this guy is forcing everyone to take part of exercise on Fridays. At the start, some people didn't like this, and they were quite quickly being made rid of. And so I think today our body is no longer the kind of possession of the state, but it's the possession not just of the corporation, but the market, or capitalism more generally. Because one of the things that is interesting when you start looking into the fact that corporations are assumed to take a great responsibility for people's health is the fact that you have a lot of people who are unemployed, not to mention the growing number of people who are part of what is now often called the precariat, people who have project employment contracts, etc. So I think that would be the main difference, that today the body belongs not to the state but to capitalism, with this idea that it is the individual's responsibility to maximize our own wellness.
When I read your book, I was sort of starting to kind of question, does this ideology of wellness really work in the way it's supposed to work? Let's say in psychoanalysis, we know very well that people are not searching to maximize their pleasure and minimize their pain, which is why psychoanalysis is very much against utilitarianism. Now, there is a certain enjoyment in failure. Isn't a part of this ideology of wellness actually that we in some way find always a way not to do the exercise, to eat that, you know, cake which we shouldn't, and, you know, through the feeling of guilt, we find a particular kind of enjoyment?
So there's a few answers to that. One of the things which we found most surprising when we were doing research on this book is, even measured on utilitarian bases, many of these wellness interventions fail. Let me just give you one very small example from an experiment which was done by some sort of happiness economists. They basically got two groups of people, and they showed both groups the same film, which was an ice skater winning a prize. It's something that apparently is supposed to make college students in the US very, very happy. I don't know if it would be the same in this audience here, but let's assume it is. But then the only difference between these two groups, one group were given a statement to read out beforehand, which is to say happiness is very important, to live a happy and fulfilling life is extremely important. The other group didn't read this out. Then they measured them using their standard measures afterwards, how happy are them. And they found out the group actually who'd read the statement to begin with felt worse after watching this thing, right? And the other group actually felt quite good. So what this begins to point out to us is that even on this basis, being forced to think about how happy you are constantly actually makes you less happy. And in many ways, this is what many of these interventions are doing. So imagine if you have your smartphone in your pocket buzzing right now. Tell me on a scale of 1 to 5, how happy are you feeling now? Then you'll start to think, well, you know, how happy really am I feeling? Did that coffee we just shared together before this really make you happy? So I think that's one point. On utilitarian bases, these things don't work. The second point, which is, I think, the more interesting question which you're raising, is, so why do we do it then? And you're saying, well, maybe it's actually this kind of sense of guilt and the precise failure which makes us attractive in the first place. And we completely agree with you, and this is what we took from your work. So if you think about dieting, right? Dieting is one of these kind of practices which we all get into, but 95% of the time fails, right? So most of the time, people actually end up becoming more overweight rather than less when they diet. So why do people diet? The reason people diet partially is about this kind of, you know, they feel like they're forced to, this fantasy. Often the fantasies lead them into the situation where they say, I think on average, the average American dieter, if you ask them how much they want to lose, something like 33% of their body weight, right? Which is completely irrational. But so they set up with these irrational outcomes, not going to happen. So what do they diet? Well, they engage in this community of guilt, right? So when they eat the cake, which they're not supposed to, then they can sit down, and it becomes even better if you have a little group of people you can share your guilty secrets with and say, well, actually, you know, I ate this cake yesterday. So in many ways, you can think that sort of 50 years ago, we used to talk about sex the same way we talk about dieting. Oh, I did this really naughty thing. Oh, it's so dirty, you know. We can't talk about that anywhere because it's out there everywhere. Now food becomes pleasurable precisely because we can share our guilty secrets with each other.
I think the one thing to add to that is that whereas transgression, that moment when you do enjoy the cigarette or you do enjoy that cake you weren't supposed to eat, there might be a sense of momentary liberation of freedom, but I think quite rapidly that is changing into the opposite, a stronger sense of being caught in this. So for every time you violate the things you're supposed to follow, you're becoming even more sort of drawn into that that logic.
In psychoanalytic kind of discussions in the last year, there have been a lot of the talk about the change in the nature of authorities. So parents want to be friends to their children, teachers are not authorities anymore, religious leaders, state leaders even less. So a person became more and more his or her own prohibitor. Mm. So doesn't, you know, this kind of a need for wellness go together actually with this, you know, sort of turn to become your own authority?
Mm. Well, definitely. And that's a very sort of central part of the book. I think some of the most extreme examples of this is how we now see the explosion of different form of technology apps, smartphone apps that we could use in order to improve our wellness. And this is something that we download voluntarily, individually, and we use them in order to become better versions of ourselves. But there's been an interesting trend recently when you look into these apps, and it is that much of them has been based on the ideas of behaviorism, of reinforcing and rewarding good behavior. So if you do this one thing, you get a, you know, some kind of reward. But now the latest trend is that it's been introducing punishment more and more. So there's one app, I think, called Gym Pack, where you sign up to go to the gym, let's say, twice every week. In the event of you missing one event, and you know there's no cheating because you have the GPS, so you can see if you've actually been at the gym, unless you want to hide in the closet room and eat, you know, biscuits. Maybe then you could cheat it. But then you have to pay a penalty, and that penalty is then being shared by those people who signed up to Gym Pack who have followed. Another more recent example, which takes this even further, is an app called Pavlok. So what you do is that you write down all of the things, that the rules that you set yourself. It could be to not smoke. It could be to eat correct. You know, you could, you know, there's infinite possibilities of the rules. It's your own making. And in the event of you not following the rules that you put, you first get a small warning because you have this wristband. it beeps, if you don't instantly change your course of behavior, it's going to send out electric shocks. So we're now in this, how do we describe this? I think, you know, is this, we talk about this like some kind of sort of totalitarian individualism, because it's about taking ownership of your own life, reshaping your life to become better, but then this extremely punitive, it's like the Milgram experiment on ourselves.
So, Andre, how do you explain this search for torture?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is that when you get, and in some ways, at least on the surface level, traditional figures of authority, such as politicians, almost abdicating that role. So an example of this recently, when I was coming back from Helsinki, I was looking in the in-flight magazine as we were taking off, kind of, you know, boring but fun at the same time, enjoying the boredom. And there was a thing at the back, and there was some very peculiar-looking guy giving lifestyle advice, and I was reading through it and thinking, who is this? It was the Prime Minister of Finland, and he seems to spend a lot of time giving lifestyle advice to people, right? So there's this idea that somehow authority figures become these kind of life coaches at the same time as we then begin to punish ourselves. So there's this sort of bizarre shift in many ways from we become authoritarian towards ourselves, and authority figures just become these kind of friendly coaches, I think, as you point out.
Yeah, many politicians boast how many hours they spent in gym. You know, so you wonder how many hours they really spent running the country, usually less than being in the gym. Now, a special part of your book focuses also on our obsession with sort of various cooking masters, the new authorities from the, you know, sort of the chefs, the cooking business. And I'm sure Jamie Oliver is not too keen on, you know, kind of promoting your book. He's like one of the...
Yeah. Well, so one thing which we talk about in this book is the kind of rise of... One thing you cannot miss in our culture is the rise of celebrity chefs and food obsession, right? And so many of these chefs kind of present themselves as a perfect identity position we could take on. So for the kind of disillusioned teacher, there's Hugh Fanning in Wetting Stall, who can imagine if they're like gone out and like lived on the side, you know, as a lifestyle. For the middle-aged man, there's Rick Stein, who can imagine they're living in a seaside village, etc., etc. But, you know, Jamie Oliver, in many ways, is the most amazing of these ones, because he can put on all of these different identities and give us this imagination where both being a kind of new lad who's able to roll out a focaccia between watching some soft porn and doing something else, someone who takes care of their family while sitting around a campfire, and also someone who can save the world. So I think what's most fascinating about these people is the fact that they begin to kind of see food projects as a means of not just kind of giving us an identity, but saving the world. So the Jamie's School Dinners example, even though it's kind of, we would all say, very fine and good, it kind of trades on this fantasy of being kind of, here comes the celebrity chef to the rescue kind of mode. And I think this has been taken even to greater extremes. Last week I noticed there was an Australian chef, I can't remember the guy's name, who's recently written a paleo diet book for toddlers, right? And so this is obviously ludicrous, but this person sort of believes somehow that by teaching, you know, it's forcing two-year-olds to eat liver soup or whatever is somehow going to kind of radically change society. So it seems our kind of beliefs have got to such a level that just by changing one or two small things which we eat, we feel like we can radically reshape the social structure.
Austrian philosopher Robert Thaler invented the term interpassivity. His idea was that a lot of the times, actually, you know, when we watch television programs, we watch them so that we don't need to do something. Let's say you have, you know, shows with canned laughter, and, you know, it's like television is laughing for you, and you don't need to laugh yourself, or you know, you are photocopying the books, which you will never read, but it appears as if the machine already read the book instead of you, or you are endlessly, you know, recording films you will never watch. You know, the recorder watched them for you. So isn't in some way this kind of obsession with the new chefs another form of interpassivity? Jamie Oliver can cook, you know, whatever, you know, and I feel very happy. I don't need to cook, you know, I just watch him cooking, you know. And in some way, he also sort of transgresses for me, because in this healthy food, there is quite a lot of butter and all this stuff, which actually I'm not allowed to eat. So isn't there a role for us actually not to do things because we just watch someone else doing it?
That's a good point. I don't think we ever really thought about that, but certainly, I mean, this would be the way of sort of rescuing the sort of wellness industry and saying that they do actually help us not to engage too much about it. I mean, I think there's much to that idea, and I love those examples. But I think at the same time, there is something more menacing going on. I'm not blaming people working in the wellness industry as such, but I think the focus and the extremely strong imperative that we find today about being healthy is something that perhaps we can read a wellness magazine and feel, okay, we don't have to think about this. But I think what is happening, especially for those people who might find themselves lower down in the social hierarchy, people who are smoking or people who are obese, are constantly being reminded that since they don't live up to the different kind of wellness indicators we have today, they are bad people. So I think for them, reading a wellness magazine wouldn't necessarily make them feel, oh, now I've done that, now I don't need to sort of take care of my own body. That would be my take, I think.
So what can we do to, you know, go against this ideology? The main point of your book is really that today's capitalism sort of relies on, you know, people feeling unhappy, and, you know, that the wellness industry is actually another form of social control. And instead of getting raise in your work, you're encouraged to sort of exercise and be more productive. So is there a way to counter this ideology? Is a way to just, you know, eat whatever we want, not exercise, be as lazy as possible, since at the end we will die anyhow, you know, like.
So, one of the chapters towards the end of the book, we kind of got interest in these anti-wellness movements, right? So we start off by looking at kind of laziness as a form. So there's this deep pleasure. A few weeks ago, I got some sort of tonsillitis, and it was like horrible. But at the same time, I was finally removed of this obligation to do things, right? So I was feeling, lying in bed, feeling like absolute hell. But I could actually kind of catch up on my life and maybe read a tiny bit, maybe watch a film without feeling guilty I wasn't going for a run or doing my work or checking my emails and so on. But obviously, if that went beyond a few days or a week, then suddenly my employer might start getting worried and people will start coming around and all those kind of things. So there are strict limits on it. But the interesting thing we begin to point out is that there's a whole series of these anti-wellness movements, but many of them seem to have reflected the very characteristics of wellness themselves. So I'll just give you one example. There's something which we came across last year called health goth. Right? So if you think about the movement which celebrates unhappiness the most, it's emos or goths, right? They dress in black and talk about how depressed they are, listen to lots of depressing music. But the most recent kind of form of this is goths who dress in black, kind of have stuff about how depressed they are, but then go to the gym and work out really hard at the gym. And there's a whole line of clothing around this. So if you're interested in why everyone is wearing these black Nike shoes at the moment and lots of black exercise gear, it's the kind of links with this kind of health goth movement. So the interesting thing is that even these resistances against it seem to be kind of inculcated with it. So that's kind of one observation we'd make. But I think we'd say that there's probably not no escape. I don't know if Carl wants to give this sort of slightly more positive picture on it.
Well, I mean, just a few things perhaps we could do as human beings. One is to try and start not mixing up morality and health. You know, just being a healthy person does not mean that you are an ethically superior person. That would be a one start. The other thing is not to think about the body as a truth system. And this is an interesting point that has been made in a book called The Coming of the Body, how today we begin to look at our bodies as a kind of truth system. We listen to our signals and we try to pick up, the kind of decode what we hear from our bodies. And by doing that, we get not just to know ourselves better, but we get a better idea of everything. And we would say that actually truth will not be found within your body. It's just, you know, a lot of sort of stuff, liquid stuff in there, you know. So it's better to think about truth as something that lies outside of ourselves, something that lies between people, and something that we find in politics, in sort of social engagement, any kind of engagement which is not too narcissistically bodily, I would say.
So it looks that in times where we have so little control over, you know, the world around us, where we are fairly passive politically because we just don't think that we can change that much when we, you know, go voting from one party or another because they pretty much look similar, where we are also in some way anxious about where we are going as society, global warming, you know, is here, and, you know, the social divisions are becoming bigger and bigger. So in this time, it quite often appears that our body is the only object where individually we might have a little bit of control. Now, unfortunately, it appears that the subject today is kind of more and more eating himself or herself, not only that we are working longer and longer, we are also, as you point out in the book, constantly obsessing of what we are eating and, you know, try in a way not to eat, you know, kind of endlessly become hungry. Now, in psychoanalytic domain, you will see all kinds of new symptoms, especially psychosomatic symptoms related to food. Now, even, you know, nowadays sometimes it's very difficult to make a dinner party because everyone has a particular kind of intolerance, you know. I never heard of gluten in my childhood, but now, you know, shops have more gluten-free food than anything else. So it appears that the whole industry is emerging out of it.
My daughter believes she's gluten allergic and asks if there is gluten in water and things like that.
So is there a way to counter this precisely, you know, in regard to the food industry? While we cannot, you know, sort of say that we really know what is in the food we are buying because the states are investing less and less in the agencies which are supposed to be in charge. So, you know, isn't there a kind of, let's say, a positive element in this wellness obsession also, a kind of a political element which can go against, you know, sort of the state forgetting about
absolutely.
Doing its job?
I mean, there's a kind of a fascinating trade-off here, right? Because at the very same time where we become more and more obsessed with wellness, the impossibility of actually finding it becomes more and more intense, right? So if we just think about the food which we eat, we have no idea about the sort of supply chain, and even the people who are actually making the food don't really know where many of the ingredients comes from. So then our attempts to kind of capture that are sort of, you know, it's trapped in this kind of roundabout. So I think kind of the attempts to begin to understand what's in our food is certainly, I think, a heroic movement, an important part of doing this. So I think these would be one of the things which would say that certainly this is a useful thing to do, but it's very, very difficult. I mean, there's been recent investigations which have gone to like local shops in the UK and found that 30% of the food is mislabeled or something like this, which is, you know, astounding.
Last question before I open the floor is, you analyze very well this, you know, happiness industry and wellness and happiness industry seems to be go together and the measurement of happiness and so on. Now, is there a way to actually really counter this happiness obsession and accept the fact that we should maybe really embrace misery? Because what's life? And then, you know, kind of going from one misery to another with a little moment of whatever, you know, joy we can find.
I mean, there is a book that came out a few years ago called Against Happiness, and then it's making a case instead of or melancholia. And I have a problem with that argument. For me, in some ways, it seems that you replace one imperative with another. So one of the things we do in this book, and we do it deliberately, is that we don't actually present an alternative imperative, and we think that maybe that is what we need, not to replace the pursuit of happiness for the pursuit of health or the pursuit of health for the pursuit of something else, but trying to disconnect and sort of see, sort of make visible the different sort of pitfalls and problems there are in in dedicating yourself to these pursuits.
The final thing I'd just add to that, I think, is that where we kind of almost got to at the end of the book, and I don't think it's kind of said explicitly, is just simply an acceptance of the fact that we're going to have multiple emotions in our lives, right? Sometimes it's going to be happiness, sometimes it's going to be melancholia, sometimes it's going to be curiosity. And if you simply kind of set this one-track sort of image of emotions, then you're going to lead a quite pathetic life, I think. But the second thing is that also we need to accept that we have limitations, but the nature of being a human is to be limited in one way or another, and to recognize that happiness is not always for us, right? Or it's always kind of limited in some ways.
Maybe I could just end there with the wonderful line from Beckett's Waiting for Godot, and I think it is Estragon who tells Vladimir to say that he's happy, and after a while they say, I am happy, and then if it is Vladimir who goes, so what do we do now that we're happy?
Okay, so I would kindly ask for questions from the audience.
So I'm following what's happening in the technology space and how it might impact our freedom to make decisions. And for example, you'll hear a term called the Internet of Things, where all these machines and gadgets and sensors will be linked up and help us improve our lives. So Mitsubishi in Japan have got a concept of a smart home in the future they're working on, where one of the examples they give is that you'd be wearing these sensors, you'd walk into your house, and as you approach the fridge door would link to the sensors from your body, understand the state of your health, and be linked to the contents of your fridge, and the fridge door would display healthy suggestions optimized for you. So my question is, this is what they think people want. Is that, you know, will consumers actually embrace that, or will they feel that's too much like Big Brother?
Well, can I answer that sort of obliquely? One of the things that Carl and I have sort of been working on since the book came out is this idea of not the Internet of Things, but the Internet of Me. So the big trade show where you show off all of these various gadgets every year, the major theme this year was wearables, right? So the smartwatch, but also these weird things that you put on your head and it scans your brain waves all the time and so on. So I think what's interesting there is to begin to understand these kind of interventions at this level. And not only are companies very interested in it, other authority figures are kind of interested in it. But what's fascinating here is that as we live in a society where the state's kind of withdrawing from so many aspects of life and saying we don't want to do it, it's also becoming incredibly interventionist, right? So the state is no longer providing me with education or whatever, but it's quite willing to tell me when I should go to sleep, what I should eat, et cetera, et cetera. So you get this weird movement of a complete free market for basic social services, but a high degree of intervention, or at least it's kind of snooping in these other things. And I think this Internet of Me is part of this activity. The other question you ask is, are consumers going to buy into it? Well, I mean, that's the big question. Like, if you just take smartwatches, all the data tells us, and we've done a tiny bit of research on this, is that consumers buy them, they're quite keen, but after about 6 months, they go back in the box. But the question is, will that continue? Will they stay on the arm?
I mean, I think it's a very nicely put question. But in the book, we look at a guy called Chris Dancy. He's now quite famous and known as the most connected person on Earth. But there's an interview with him from 2008 when he wasn't successful at all. It's with Wired. And the title of this magazine article is How a Middle-Aged Man Rebuilt Himself for the Future. And he starts to talk about how he collects data about himself through sensors and then wearables and all other things. And then he says that basically this is just fatalistic. This is what every other human being will do 5-10 years down the line. And this really struck me as a kind of a crucial thing. And we've been talking about this later on. Because if you go back to the late 1960s, when you had a kind of explosion of people who wanted to find out who they really were, people going to the SLN Institute and going and participating in all forms of really weird workshops, but all with the intention of finding out who they really were. These were people who'd been really fed up and bored with the demands that was placed on them from society oh, I want you to take over the family business, you have to comply to these rules. So these were people who wanted to opt out of society. They wanted to go there and find a better, more truthful, more authentic life. And then in the 1970s, you had people like Christopher Lash and Tom Wolfe and others ridiculing these people, calling them narcissists, calling this a kind of culture of narcissism. I think what you have today with someone like Chris Dancy, not to mention a lot of young people doing the same things, is also narcissists, but a new kind of narcissist. And we think of them as it's a kind of compulsory narcissism. They don't do these things in order to opt out of society, to break away from the rules imposed on them. On the contrary, it seems as a way for them to make sure that they fit in, to be more marketable, to be more employable. And that is, I think, where it's becoming in some ways most scary. If people were doing this just because they were obsessed with themselves, that would be one thing. We could laugh at it. But if they do it, and if people will start doing this more collectively as a way to becoming better, to becoming a sort of enhanced version of themselves, then that is a more frightening scenario. And then we no longer even have that question, do I really want what I want? Do I really want that healthy food in the fridge? The question like that does not appear. The question instead is, will this food and all of these senses and all of the other things that I engage in, are they going to help me improve my market value?
I think you can improve your market value if the fridge then eats that food instead of you. So I will collect three questions.
Hi, thank you very much. My quick question is, how does what you've written about in the Wilder Syndrome relate to the Happy Planet Index and the way we think about meta societies in terms of who is happy and who isn't?
I suppose I wanted to take the comment that was made earlier. You said about the fridge and what I want, but isn't the real question what I need? And really, then the question is, who's best placed to help people understand the kind of things that they need?
I was just wondering how much it's related to social status, because obviously personal trainers always used to be in the realm of the rich, and now that's becoming more accessible. So I was wondering, is it just a way for us to compete against each other?
With the happiness index, I mean, we think that any kind of new ways of measuring how countries do, which is not about GDP, might be a very good thing. But if you look into what they're actually doing, if you take the survey that is being done here, which was initiated by David Cameron a few years ago. Interestingly, that whole idea came out of and was being inspired by the work by Martin Seligman. So Martin Seligman is this kind of high priest of positive psychology. He would not like to be called, being related to positive thinking, but it's very similar, I would argue. And we argue about that in the book. But so the interesting thing here is, okay, so they do measure happiness. They have these four questions. I think when they did it the first year, they got an average of 7.8 or whatever. The opposition then went out and said, well, this says nothing. This is just sort of stating the bleeding obvious. But I think it raises sort of a larger question. Now I'm not talking about the happiness index as such. I'm talking about what was happening in this country. Is, you know, maybe we should ask the question, why is it that David Cameron is interested in measuring happiness now, at the height of other austerity measures? And why is it that he takes inspiration from Martin Seligman, whose main point is that circumstances play no difference? In other words, if you grow up in a very poor neighborhood, let's say Middle Haven, where the average life expectancy for men is 6 years old, you will still be no more, no less happy than other people, according to Martin Seligman and the research with a big, huge, massive R has produced. And then you could have this. So I'm not sure what they actually done with this happiness happiness measures. But for me, it seems that drawing attention to happiness now has been a way of escaping larger questions about class, about justice, and about all of those political questions, which are much more pressing, much more acute, but which are being swept under the carpet, and where ideologies that you get in positive thinking, and I would argue positive psychology, are very helpful sort of rhetorical devices.
So the question about status, I mean, this is an interesting one. We thought of this as a kind of an upper middle class conceit when we started out, right? The life coach and all of that sort of stuff. One small observation here, a colleague of mine who studies elite law firms, she noticed during about a four-year project she was running, at the start, none of the partners had life coaches, maybe one or two who are freaks. All of them now have life coaches, right? So there's this kind of rise of this kind of coaching as a kind of compulsory practice, as a fairly new practice, and then also kind of lifestyle issues become kind of vital aspects to it. So there's loads of evidence you could begin to point out there. But the interesting thing, which then goes alongside of this, is, well, it doesn't seem to just be about the kind of upper middle classes now. It seems to have almost gone right to the bottom of society, you know, the kind of people who are forced to kind of be compulsorily coached. So one of Carl and I's friends and colleagues has just finished a big study, which has just been published in Sweden, about unemployment services. What's interesting here, and I think it's reflected in the UK, is that you get this kind of compulsory lifestyle intervention where it's no longer good enough not to just be paid to, very low, and you don't have to just be checked in, one or two days a week. You have to actually go along and have this life coach tell you, work on your CV, doing all of this endless work, which makes you actually feel worse about yourself. And you're being told to think positively while you see a whole community of people around you. So there's this kind of almost kind of enforced wellness on people who are often, patently not well.
Exactly. And you had Paul Ryan as well, who you might be familiar with, the Ayn Rand fan, and also candidating with Mitt Romney, who I think about a year ago or so said that all poor people in the United States should be given the opportunity to meet a life coach, and how the life coach would be the answer to the fact that they are poor. So in some ways, it would have been better if this would have been a middle-class obsession, but the really kind of cruel aspect of this, we would say, is when it is being enforced onto those people who would find themselves in the most vulnerable position in society and being told that the reason why they are there is because they haven't been putting in enough effort, haven't done enough exercise, or haven't been thinking positively enough. Just a final example of this is a study from the United States of unemployed people meeting coaches where the unemployed people were prohibited from using the word unemployment, because that would reveal a bad attitude. And they were also asked not to read the newspapers or watch the news on television.
So I should also just acknowledge this gentleman's question, which is a good one. I'm not actually sure how to answer. We'd find our own needs, because it's an extremely difficult question. Are we best placed to know what we really need? So, I mean, I theoretically know what I should do. But we know that all of us as humans are very weak in terms of carrying out what we need. And I think one thing I would take from a lot of the kind of behavioural science stuff is that there's loads of cognitive traps which force us, which stop us from carrying out what we need in some ways.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time. Thank you very much, both of you, to explain this wonderful theme. And now I would just like to thank Carl and Andre for a wonderful presentation. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.